Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
nuclear magnetic resonance techniques to do fundamental basic organic chemistry, So let's talk about this. I'm going to try and tell you this fantastic technique where you can put a sample in a massive magnetic field and excite it with radio waves, and it sends a pulse back, but at different frequencies, and the actual position of the frequencies and the actual peaks in the frequency spectrum tell you precise information about an atom, about a molecule, sufficient information to unplug even the most complex of molecules. It's sort of basically you line up the atoms and it tells you information, precise information. It's like it, like texting it and getting its SIM number. It's sort of the molecule metadata comes out, but in fact it's not metadata, it's the actual raw data that comes streaming out of atoms if you do the simple thing of putting it in a massive magnetic field. Now, the basic thing is this magnetic field interacts with electrons, obviously, when it when you've got an atom and you put an atom in a magnetic field, you get this splitting. Different orbitals have different magnetic moments, and you get this thing called Zeeman splitting of the electrons. But you also have, and this is because the electrons are magnets. You put magnets in a magnetic field, they are constrained to split. Now, unlike a normal magnet, a compass needle, which can point in all directions, your compass, your quantum compass, can only point north or south. It can't point east or west. It's a pretty amazing thing in quantum mechanics. So this is an important aspect, or you can point a number of degrees away from it. So this is a fundamental theme, that your fundamental particles, electrons, protons, even neutrons, have a small magnetic field. They are small magnets. Electrons and protons have charges, but they all have got magnetism, and the magnetism is not due to motion. It's not due to anything. It's just, it's not due to, the magnetism isn't changed, created by somehow the motion of a electric field. However, so I'm just turning at this point in time. However, there is sort of intrinsic motion inside the, trapped up in a stationary particle, because you have these two to make a particle, and the way that we can make it, we can make a particle and an antiparticle, but to make a particle, you make particles out of the basic ingredients of space and energy. Energy in the forms of energized space. An energized space is called light. And so you have these two photons come in, crash together. They crash and tie a knot in space. And that knot, that motion of the knot, is still remembers the its creation. And that creation has basically tangled up inside an electric field, and that's zeroed. However, it's still got a little remnant of the magnetic field from the photons, the electromagnetic radiation, which made it up. So if you'd like to think of it this way, that there is some primeval magnetic field still captured within the actual particle itself. It's intrinsic to the field. So you have the protons, or this is just a proton, helium atoms. It's just helium nuclei. And these are scattered throughout the organic compounds. It's bonding, and hydrogen is ubiquitous. One in every three atoms in the universe is a hydrogen. The others are most likely to be helium, and occasionally you'll get a few others, very rare other atoms out there. Now, the nature of us forming a planet is that we have basically a bit of, if you can imagine, the shit in your dishwasher filter. Basically, the shit which occurs when you hold your fuel filter, there's bits of grime, or your air conditioning, there's bits of dust. We are bits of really the most insignificant piece of dust. And as a piece of dust, we've got all this odd shit, which is the rest of the periodic table. But most of the universe is this hydrogen helium, and this hydrogen are these individual protons, and these protons, when they're made up, have spin. They have spin, but they're not rotating. So they've got primeval angular momentum inside them, but they are not actually spinning, which is sort of an interesting aspect to it, and that's relevant to it. And they've also got primeval magnetic field. So it's got a magnetic field, yet it's got no current. There is no current in a proton because there is no motion in a proton, because you need parts to be a motion. To define motion, you need a object in space to draw a circle around it and then clock it at one point and see where it's at the next instant of time. There's motion, but it's, we can do the time thing okay, but we can't put a circle around a bit of a proton and actually say that was that part of the proton which is towards us is now behind us because it's spun. We're just not allowed to do that because the proton is so small. It's a fundamental particle. It has spin, and by looking at these magnets and considering them as antenna, we can make a proton in a magnetic field, basically a small radio receiver, an antenna, and a battery. And this is precisely it, that basically a proton can align with or against the magnetic field. Now, if it's aligned against the magnetic field, it's storing energy. It can release energy. And so your proton spin can flip. Now, this is it. When it flips, it actually doesn't geometrically flip the way that I would flip a pen. It's more closely to flip how I turn a sock right way to outside, inside to outside. That's a closer analogy to it. So flipping it as a word is bad because it gives people the wrong starting idea of a spin flipping. So, how do you say? I can't really rage against all of science, all the English language, for not setting us up with the right words, but there it is. We're not set. A proton actually gets pulled inside out. So it's right side out. It can actually go with the magnetic field. Now, it's got spin. It's got a magnetic field, which means it's got it will be pulled. Now, this is interesting. A dipole, a magnet, if you hold a magnet, it will be pulled towards another magnet, but that dipole is actually measuring the gradient of the magnetic field. So that's one thing that the strength of magnetic field that we feel, we're actually measuring the gradient of magnetic field. However, you actually feel the strength of magnetic field, not by the actual pull of the magnet, but by the amount of twist of light to a magnet. Now, this primeval twist that is felt and the primeval angular momentum leads to something if we expand out. So if you actually go down to a proton, as you go down to the small size of a proton, you lose the ability. The proton is like a Cheshire cat. Only the smile exists. Only the that which is not imaginable but is intelligible. At the end of that, we cannot imagine a proton spin. It can be intelligible. We can tell you about it. We can tell you facts about it, but we can't imagine it. It's a bit like this person at the party that everyone knows about but has never met. And eventually, they sort of like big brother. where this voice comes from above and you're supposed to try and work out exactly what it means coming across. So this is about spin. And if I can say, you adding spin, a primeval property of the angular momentum and a primeval property of the magnetic field, you also get this called precession. And this is, you see a bit of precession if you see a top begin to wobble. As it begins to turn, it stops falling. It's got a force of gravity getting it to top level, but a force back up of it actually of its spin. Its spin creates a counteracting force to it, and that means that there's actually a uniform force which makes it accelerate, definitely accelerate, but accelerate in a circle. So similarly to a satellite is always falling towards Earth, but it falls in such a way that it doesn't gain energy. It just acceleration can change its direction, not energy. So similarly to the fact that steering a car changes its direction, but it's not actually speeding your car up or slowing down. You can't get your car to go forward by wobbling your steering wheel, so to speak. So you get this thing called, I'm just going to watch this here, mate, because I've got this little thing here, just checking out I'm doing the right thing. To get in, I'm actually podcasting while driving. I'm sort of driving in the heat down to pick up some pool cleansing chemical and also do a river walk in intense heat. But we're talking about spin and magnetic field and a proton, which there are thousands of them. It's sort of like the pepper steak. It's sort of like seasoned. Organic molecules are seasoned with wherever there's a gap, we can pluck it up with a little hydrogen atom. And those hydrogen atoms are or protons are indeed little antenna which can actually store energy. Well, store energy collectively, sort of forms a little sort of tuned radio circuit. Yep, you can turn into my molecule FM. It's not free. Well, I suppose this is for work out whether you call it AM or FM. To really think about that one, but yeah, your molecule in a magnetic field is a radio. There we go. Let's see how we go through here. Thanks a lot, and I'll be with you in a second. I've got to go into the store and buy some pool chemical. I'll be back in a while. Okay, back again teaching about or talking about spin. Now, just watching for a car, so don't crash into a car, so I'm just about going to talk about it. Now, you sort of become aware that you have an understanding of quantum mechanics and of spin, and your understanding is pulling back your understanding, replacing fake understanding, which is sort of imagining what is not. So you can imagine what is not creatively or destructively. Now, I don't know. Look, I think I'm the only person I can definitely say this. I know very few people, so therefore this has got to be likely. I'm the only person who even knows about spin not actually being physically, mechanically spinning. Yeah, there you go. And I think people tend to say, get really upset. There's this core cultural thing that if a belief has been established by culture, there is this natural thing to actually have a cultural. So if you have a cultural belief, there is a cultural response to actually ostracize people who have a belief varying from the cultural belief. That is, to suddenly say, well, look, how do you know your degree of expertise? How do you know this is true? You never believe anything that's believed in Wikipedia, and so I suppose my response is that, well, therefore you say that you're better than Wikipedia, or no, not. You're just the same as Wikipedia, so I shouldn't believe you. You sort of get yourself in the regime of not believing anything, or if you got this logical, if you apply the logic of not believing you, you know, I don't know, it's this casting of ignorance. It's sort of like a mud bath of ignorance that they're slinging at each other. So you have this thing, the electron is spinning, it's got a spin, and it's got an angular momentum, and it does have this thing called precession. That is, in the magnetic field will tend to create a torque. And so as this torque, as you ramp up the magnetic field, the torque will make the electron align more and more with the magnetic field, but it won't get there because the more you push it, the faster it spins. The faster its angular momentum drags it around in a circle, and it actually does physically precess and form a circle. And we know this from a number of things, from the analysis of spectra. So what happens is that people say, oh look, this is from the spectra, this is as if it was spinning, it's a hidden spin, but you're technically not allowed to do this. Okay, so I will say, well, I am stupid, I am really so stupid, I insist that what you've said is not good enough, and that I declare that it physically does, it is a physical ball and it is physically rotating. I declare it to be so, and I'm going to just shout down everybody else, and I'm just going to be just absolutely horrible individuals. And look, I don't say, but I think this is a symptom. We're wrecking the planet, we're doing carbon dioxide, we're being willfully stupid. It's like these people in Plato's Republic of the Ship. These people are willfully just stupid. You know, here I'm going to shit on your food, stop me. And then they get power through ignorance. My ignorance is as good as your knowledge, this type of stuff. They go and they get an axe and start to smash open the bottom of the boat, and we all sink. And that's pretty much what we're doing here at the moment, the planet, burning it down. These people, the act of stupidity is the act of stupidity I see in schools teaching spin this way. However, getting back to it, we've got spin in the magnetic field, and as the magnetic field turns on and increases in strength, the axis of the spin axis or magnetic field axis gets closest. The compass points ever further north, but the more that points north, the more that it is actually sped up, and it spins around faster and faster in a circle. So if you put a proton in a magnetic field, you create all these spinning, gyrating magnets. And a gyrating magnet, as you all know, is similar to a rotating magnet, is similar to a rotating electron or an electric field, and that will radiate. Now, of course, that's one of the things, is that if I have an atom with a spinning electron in it, it will be radiating, but it doesn't. How do we solve this? Well, I know how we solve it. We call it a poor postulate, which is not at all a postulate. It is just a bullying point saying, this shopping you've just paid for, it's mine. No, it's not. Here's my receipt. It is mine by my bloody postulate. So one of Bohr's bloody postulates is that an electron spinning in, doing an orbit, gyrating in a atom, radiates. Sorry, I'm going to sneeze. Sorry, that was fantastic. I've had a new valve in my heart, and sneezing is now just completely... What was all that fuss about? I'm enjoying my sneeze so much. Okay, getting back into it. I'm going to get my sneeze in a little while soon. Okay, so anything rotating, any magnetic rotating, any electric field going up and down. So if I put an electric field on a wheel and spin it very, very fast, it will radiate. Now, you say, oh, well, yeah, well, if I want a you know, how come my radio isn't an electron on a wheel going up and down? Well, it is. That's your antenna. Rather than going up and down in two dimensions, it only goes up and down in one dimension. It's actually spinning. Your electron is going in a circle, but in one direction. It's sort of like a comet going back and forth from the sun, back and forth, and highly elliptical stuff. Now, this is also true for a proton in a magnetic field will radiate. However, we have something known as wave superposition. So radiation to get out has to be do a number of things. Firstly, it's got to radiation has to get in a traveling wave. The magnetic field has to get out of sync with the electric field. Otherwise, it creates a non-traveling light wave, a stationary light wave. Well, where is the stationary light wave? Well, within an atom, I'll tell you. So, okay. Within an atom going up and down. Indeed, when you understand it, an atom which is excited actually is an atom plus a photon stuck inside it. And it's sort of like a juggle. Light goes into it, and it's like a juggler. You toss another ball to it, it can juggle that light. And so this is when the atom absorbs some light. You can really see it if you don't get, bear the English, fucked in the head by people teaching you crap. This is the ball electron is just a nightmare to do it. You can see so much if you actually understand the quantum mechanics for it. So I'm just trying to explain this. So now the reason that these protons don't radiate, well, I have to tell you, they do radiate, and they do radiate if you can actually get it to actually be in phase. Now, the problem with waves, and the advantages of waves, is that you can, for every wave... Now, what the fuck's going on here? Shit. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't say this. My favourite park for the start of the river walk, which I'm going on, is locked up. So, who knows what is going on there? How does it operate? So, I'm going to have to stop, see where I can park up here. to go. So there's something to do with Australia Day, which is really stopping this whole region. Okay, so it is Australia Day today, so the people are out, everyone's happy. Imagine that. Well, I don't know whether the 4th of July in America is like that, or Bastille Day, but everyone is just chilled, relaxed, and happy. I don't understand what it is. Everyone's a bit... No one's in a grumpy mood, if I can say that. And grumpy moods is the sort of the recipe of life. Most of life is the majority of people are in various stages of running away from grumpy people and doing things like this. Okay, getting back to the electron, sorry, or the proton in this case, it is spinning, it is rotating. If you put it in a more intense magnetic field, it gyrates faster. It's got a faster Lamor frequency, and it does radiate. However, if you put two antenna next to each other, in close proximity, they overall will not produce a radiation field which extends any distance into space. So if I can, so this is the entire thing, is I can have a radio and tune it up, just checking what's going through here. I can tune it up, but if I've got a crap antenna and so the antenna actually doesn't work, you know, it's sort of like, oh, my radio is not producing any radiation. Here we go. Whoops. Okay, I've just found a park which I can actually relate to here. Okay. So I'm just going to stop this at the moment, and I'll start talking in a short while. Okay, continuing this podcast. I was previously driving, now I'm walking around something called the River Walk of around the Nepean River. It's taking my time for a number of reasons. I'll may get onto it a bit later. But we're talking about the proton in a strong magnetic field has intrinsic magnetic field itself and its intrinsic angular momentum, which means it processes around a radius around the actual axis, goes in a circle around the magnetic field. So in a very weak magnetic field, it makes a very large angle with this axis and proceeds at a very leisurely pace. As you clock up the magnetic field, it increases to your ever closer angle and a higher frequency. And this, you would think, would radiate. And similarly to an electron in the old school, which is actually going around in a circle around an atom, you would say this would radiate, but it doesn't. Now, the way that it doesn't is basically a misreading of the use of the word postulate by Bohr, saying it doesn't radiate. We're not going to discuss that now. It's a bit like bushfires in Australia. The government, the population says, hang on, is this not climate change? And of course, the government, which is in the pay of big coal and oil companies, say, we are not going to discuss it now. It is an inappropriate time to discuss it. People are burning, are dying. We're not going to, it's inappropriate to discuss why. And similarly, it's here. all Bohr said was, we're not going to discuss it. It's an obvious problem. It's obvious, but we are going, by the dint of our status as bullies, we're not going to tell you about it. Of course, quantum mechanics has a full explanation for why it doesn't radiate. And similarly, these gyrating magnets don't radiate because they're actually not spinning. And they have the properties of it, but they've got the properties of it at a sufficiently high level that there is some aspects of it rotating and other aspects of it not rotating. The aspects of it not rotating is it's not radiating. However, it can radiate when it flips from one direction to another. Now, I sort of know how it radiates, or have a good feeling of how it radiates, because you can actually very visually see an electron radiates. So trying to understand how a rotating magnet radiates is hard. It's hard enough as it is. So for instance, I could communicate to you by a spinning magnet if I wanted to, waves across here, but the actual antenna has to go through a dipole, magnetic dipole transition, and that is the actual it's called magnetic dipole moment. It's got to actually go from one state, magnetic state, to another, and so it radiates. It absorbs radiation when it goes from aligned to counter-aligned. When it goes from counter-aligned to aligned, the energy is reduced, and the magnetic photon, if you like, magnetic light. Well, light is a combination of electric and magnetic oscillation. So it really doesn't matter how the actual energy is taken out, whether it is a charge being moved or a magnet being removed. It really doesn't matter. And amazingly, it is, as far as the light's concerned, a charge being removed. So it's pretty amazing. Yeah. Let's see, a light goes into an atom. That light is actually stored in oscillation of an atom. You've got an oscillating electromagnetic field, comes up to an atom, and it actually pulsates the wave function. So it's the pulsating wave function, therefore stores that light energy. And then a little while later, it can re-radiate it. So this is sort of light scattering over, I don't know, how you could describe. I'm looking at the blue sky, and to a certain extent, but I'm just going to read this here. So this poor chap, this person used to walk this area for 40 years, and so written a plaque for him. I'm doing a similar walk. I think it's for probably 5 kilometres round to round, probably 10, walking up the street, and there's a beautiful Nepean River. It's basically a long, long dam. They've got a weir up the other end, so it's always high level, but it can actually, in drought, before the dam used to dry up, in actual fact. Okay, getting back to it. So this atom can radiate out energy by going from from aligned to counter-aligned. So the stronger the field, the faster it rotates, the more energy is stored as it's pulled further and further to the field. So essentially, your magnet, so you've got a weak field. Your magnet makes up to nearly 90 degrees to that field. Go figure that. It's 90 degrees to the field, and it makes a leisurely turn around, and if it's against it, it's got a small angle to the field and a small dipole energy with respect to it. I find it sort of overall fascinating that the energy is, I don't know whether it's proportional to B squared or B. That would be an interesting thing to look at. Now, how does it absorb a photon? Well, the absorption of a photon is not an instantaneous thing. It's contrary to popular belief. A photon is an oscillation in electromagnetic space, and it's several wavelengths long. So there's several waves in a photon. If there's several waves in a photon, there's several periods in a photon. It's a period of time. And you can see a quantum state transition gradually as the light goes in. To a higher energy state, So it slowly reaches a high energy state. Now, so you have a situation where you've got a proton and the photon is coming in, and half the photon's arrived, and it's halfway through being pulled in. Now, I don't know whether at this stage what the actual magnetic field on the outside of it is, but it really doesn't matter. It's a system of the proton and the field around the outside of it interacting. And so what happens is that I have this train of interaction coming in into a proton. Just checking that I am recording this. Oh yeah, that's okay. Coming in, and your proton gradually changes orientation, or goes through a pulsating state, absorbing it. Now, it's in fact, a lot of this is, you cannot imagine. And you have to actually tell people, you cannot imagine SU2 symmetry. You cannot imagine a hidden property which is not visible. It is a property, a property which doesn't actually, it's actually burningly hot here. I wonder how hot it is, probably 40 degrees. You can hear the little bellbird. Now, the bellbird is a pretty amazing thing. I don't know if you can hear it in the background. They chirp. They're a social bird. They, in packs, they have wars with different other types, species of birds. So your area around in Australia, you will have one species of bird and another species of birds. And these are basically the typical Australian birds that chirping and stuff like that. But they do one thing. They have a delicacy food. They go around and eat the predator of a grub, which goes into the eucalyptus trees. So what happens is that these bellbirds come into an area, and then the eucalyptus trees become diseased, die back, the ecosystem collapses, and they move on. So it's, I don't know if people should say, well, they're not too dissimilar to humans. Okay, getting back to this, so you have a full process going on here. Now, in an NMR nuclear magnetic resonance sample, you have a very strong uniform magnetic field in your sample area. So if you can imagine, you produce between two poles of magnetic massive magnet an area of a uniform field. So the field is completely uniform. So every atom, if you had a uniform sample, the sample's of one type of thing, and it's in a uniform field, it will respond completely uniform. It's unlike yourself. If you put yourself in a big magnet, you're not uniform, and you get a garbled signal out, and the computers have a field day ungambling it and producing an image of yourself. It's not like that. We're after a different quarry. We're not after the big bulky areas of, say, areas of blood flow damage, tissue damage, that type of stuff. We want to actually see right into the actual molecule, how the molecule inside are faring out. So we put this here in an NMR spectroscopy machine, but it's specialized, and it puts in energy, radio frequency, equal to the radio frequency of your mini radios. What can I say? You turn the... I have a radio antenna, and I can turn my all hydrogens in an organic symbol into radios. It was taking heart medication at the moment, which is just putting a cap on my heart rate, which is a great thing, but it means that
exercise is that little bit more exhausting to come across here. And you can hear there's a main arterial freeway going across the river here, and you can hear that coming across here. Yeah, so when I say I can turn a hydrogen atom, a proton, which is scattered like a seasoning of a organic molecule, into a radio, I'm not, as an adult program, I'm not a wanker. I'm not saying that to impress you, or I don't really care if you think I'm an idiot. And so, so the average person would say, if you make a statement, I can turn a proton into a radio, and battery, they would say they have an option. Do I understand it? No. Is this person crazy and stupid and should be ridiculed? Yes. Clearly a radio is big and a proton is small. It can't possibly work. However, putting that argument aside, it does work, and people use this to analyze chemicals, some really interesting compounds, and say to pick up heaps of really interesting information. Okay, about it. So if you can go through it, one set of logic here is ignorance rules. I live my life in ignorance. I use ignorance in my judgment system. I just basically piss on any scientist with unbridled ignorance. So these protons are acting as radios, and that they can actually absorb a photon at the radio frequency, the precise frequency of its antenna. Go figure. I mean, that's pretty obvious, but it's about and the radio signal can a radio signal, which is a long thing. So say if I have a very weak radio signal, very, very weak, the amount of, if a very weak photon, a very weak radio photon is many, many billions and billions of wavelengths long. In fact, it's so long, it could be as long as a piece of string. And this long piece of string goes into space around a proton and gets sucked in and wrapped around the proton. And the proton is halfway through absorbing it, wheeling it in, and beginning to oscillate in space. Now, we don't have the intellectual machinery. We are SU3 universe. We are SU3 creatures. A proton is SU2. It's got a different symmetry. We don't have the visualization. We can see what happens, but the box, we don't have enough sufficient understanding to it. Now, if you have got two people at a job interview, and they say, one person says, oh, I can explain everything, oh, it's all bloody simple, blah, 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 like that, they'll get the job. However, if you then get those people out of the way, you then have a group of people who might be able to be clever enough to build NMR machines, or what do they call? NMR is nuclear magnetic resonance, and I've actually forgotten what those beautiful, beautiful medical MRI, maybe resonance imaging. They've dropped the nuclear and put the I involved in it. So you might get people, you may get certain people, and you get those people off to teach people because they're full of their own shit. and the other people who actually do understand it can go off and actually get out there, save lives, you know, actually do useful stuff. So we've got this this happening that these photons can actually go in and be stored in it. Now, there's a whole heap of things that these atoms are not very good batteries. If you can imagine the most delicate pinwheels in the fan in the breeze, and you sort of try and get them to store spinning energy, you spin them up, and then the breeze comes along and it completely scrambles it. It's a bit like that with the temperature. Temperature comes in and knocks the bejesus out of these sorts of things. How does it do it? Well, everything's got a magnetic field. The magnetic field's oscillating. If they're magnetically field coupled, that's how your proton goes around, and it's sitting in a electric magnetic field of an atom, of the electron moving around. There's heaps there, so if you vibrate, you can really screw it up. However, these samples are able to be pumped, and so if you can imagine a spinning proton, and it's processing, and you're allowed to privately imagine these things. The problem is publicly imagining them and then teaching other people your ignorance level. In fact, what happens is that teachers tend to transmit their the ignorance level of which they're accustomed to come along here. So we've got this thing that I can I can store energy, and if you can imagine a big group of protons, all the same, spinning at a particular orientation on its circumpolar trek, its position of its axis is processing around, and there's thousands of these, one at every degree on the compass going along, and what happens is that you set a wave up, a frequency in, so you can tune a frequency. What you have option is controlling the phase, and phase modulation is your FM signal, so you can control the phase of what you put in there and build the phase up. What will happen is that you will tend to pick off, say for instance, the ones at 90 degrees. Now if you pick those 90 degrees off, you then create, if you imagine a cone with these flared out around a cone, and you pick out the 90 degrees one, you create you remove those by flipping them down from 90 degrees to 70 degrees. However, you at the same time create, because it's a population of them, you create a net bias above the planet 270 degrees. So what you do is by targeting the one at 90 degrees, you create spin electron, a next spin. This is the sum of these two spins above and below the plane in the plane. So this is a complex thing that when you apply a radio wave, you actually grow a net vector, because you've got thousands of these going on. So the net population is a vector which is actually pointing in the plane of it, so the equatorial plane. So it's hard to get across in terms of you've got a fully populated cone facing outwards. You select part of that cone, rip it down and point it the opposite direction. It means that underneath you've got a small population going out, and above it you've got a net population above 70 degrees. Now, can I say that I have never, in all the explanations I've worked this out, I've never seen this explicitly explained. So when you get protons in a magnetic field and you hit it with a Lamar frequency, a radio wave with a frequency, you can caress them and get them gradually to turn inside out rather than flip. I think it's a better way of talking to them, such that they do have a net vector. If you hit at 90 degrees, you'll create a horizontal vector at a horizontal vector at 270 degrees going around, and that vector will actually process. Around the Lamar frequency that you're going in. Now, let's go into this a little bit more. That vector will then rotate around, and by the time it comes around next time, its magnetic field is therefore right for it to grow. So you will create one horizontal vector, and saturation strength of that is majority will spins will be untouched, but you're tuning one there. If you change the phase, you can keep on building more and more of a vector. That would be an interesting thing to do, to actually create a big broad phase chunk down there. Now that will go. Now that vector, your net pseudo vector, I suppose, pseudo vector, it's not really pseudo vector, composite vector, will decay in time as your protons flip back and forth, and there's less of a statistical variation in your little sample, region of sample, that will decay in time. Now that changing vector will mean that's rotating is equivalent to what you need to actually radiate. It will radiate out a pulse. So what will happen is that your sample, if you build it up with the strong magnetic field, it's a radio field going in. So your radio field is composite electric field, magnetic field, but it looks like a pulsating magnetic field, so you've got coils producing it. So that will radiate out afterwards. So if you go and then you'll hear this slight ring afterwards, ever so faintest ring, if you're picking up. So you can be really, really loud, you can hear it pumping it, and then you can hear this very faint whoa as it decays. Now, it's hard to say. A rapid decay is actually quite good because all the energy comes out. A very slow decay is not so good because you can't hear it coming out over time. And then, that's another aspect of Australia Day. You get hoons out there on bikes. You've got a sample in a strong magnetic field, the protons will go whee. And now what I'm saying is that these are radios, and so these are now exclusively sensitive to their environment, their radio operating environment, their bond conditions, and also their nearest neighbour coupling. How their energy is stored amongst them, and what's happening is a stochastic things. Of these things, you cannot imagine. I'm not saying that you it is unimaginable. It's not that you cannot do it, you don't lack the ability to it. You have nothing in your experience to truly connect you with SU2. There is simply not enough dimensions for imagination. Imagination is a three-dimensional thing. It's like, I don't know how you can describe it. It's like talking, getting a symphony orchestra to actually play ultrasonic bat tunes. It's just the sensory machinery doesn't do this, and it's at a different frequency, intellectual frequency range. So get this chirp out. Now, there's several reasons for this decay. The decay can be that the quality of the antenna degrades, in that you have different micro conditionings just beginning to mean that the antenna are slightly different speeds and they get out of sync. So it's sort of like you've got your protons and a choir of protons begins to speak, but they're all singing at slightly different frequencies. So the first song it's in piece, but they've all got slightly different metronomes. The second and the third piece, it's just and you get no signal, exquisite signal that you can pick up. And we'll be back with you in a tick. Okay, I just stopped in there for a brief toilet break, and you didn't need to hear the sound effects of me going to the toilet and the flushing and all that type of stuff, although Australian toilets are different from what you would experience overseas. They're sort of like a capture from what was around in Victorian England, and the rest of the world have moved around with. You've got these big piss walls you piss against, and stainless steel affairs, and that's a constant affair, constant amusement to people coming from overseas to see this, you know, sophisticated society with not such a sophisticated male toiletry arrangement. Our blokes haven't really listened to people all that much coming in. Things are changing though. Okay, getting back into this. You have this system that fortunately not everyone has been taking what teachers have taught them literally. They sort of have an understanding of what's gone on, and the scientists have been able to then add after it a reversal pulse. Now I think I can sort of work out how this works. I haven't seen it written up in a way that I can fully understand it, and I haven't spoken to experts in the field. And then again, when you just speak to experts in the field, they say, oh look, no, I'm a specialist PhD in this area, or why am I speaking to you, jerk, that type of stuff. So look, there's just a limitation, but there is this pulse they can put in, which means that the actual vector gets realigned pion to change, which has the effect of so there's a period of time, and then you go bang, and you hit it, and what happens is that your vector, which is your vectors which have got say 10 degrees in advance, are then pushed 10 degrees behind. 20 degrees in advance are then pushed 20 degrees behind a vector which was moving around 20 degrees, 10 degrees too slowly is put 10 degrees in advance. Now I have a way of understanding this in terms of that if you have a broad spectra which is agnostic to the actual. So the first one is a long pulse and is very phase sensitive. If you have a very sharp pulse, which is phase insensitive, you scramble everything and result. Result coming out. So I've got an idea of the wave form, and you have to do a bit of, I suppose, Fourier analysis to sort of understand that about short pulses have a less phase specific. They're a strong of multiple phases put together. And so this comes in, and the end result is that you create a population, you know, that's going to reach a period. Say if it takes, you do this, and you can actually do this, say, a tenth of a second after, and then 2/10 of a second after, the fast ones, which are travelling too fast, will now be at a precise time where they're at the same rate as the slow ones. The slow ones, which are given a head start, then lag behind, and they all line up again. And you get this tiny little pulse coming out. All of these systems, this is called an echo, a spin echo. And to understand it, you can't possibly understand it. It's one of these things that if people are ignorant and tell you to think in terms of the tops and flipping it in terms of actually flipping the pole, you can't actually fully understand it. You can't understand why things radiate. Once some person started postulating, you can't turn off the postulation tap. So quantum physics is really no postulates. There's no postulates. So postulate-free super theory. So a shit theory is one with postulates. Bohr's has got three postulates. I've forgotten what they are. But yeah, just... yeah. They just... shut up and listen type of thing. Quantum mechanics isn't like that. So you get these pulses. Now, this is where it becomes really interesting. As far as I can understand, the actual local magnetic field something's in is to some extent to do with the type of bond it's in. But now the interesting thing is that if I've got multiple hydrogens on the same carbon atom, they don't care about it. Now, as far as I can see, that the ability to couple is also required with some some degree of freedom of the proton. So the protons on the same atom are really tightly held in the same position. However, if they're one atom away, their position can vibrate and respond. They're sort of like they're mechanically less coupled, and this means that they can actually create a crosstalk. That is protons tuned to one atom have some energy pull across to or resonance with their partner, and therefore you get this amazing stuff. So if you've got a protons and a carbon, and those carbons are then bound to other carbons, and there's no protons on those side carbons, so they've got oxygens, nitrogens, chlorines on them, whatever they are, just stuff in there, non-magnetic shit, you'll get a single peak out. That is now this really, this really hurts my head to think about it. You get one peak. So I suppose that's a singlet. Now, if you have on your neighbouring atoms one extra hydrogen, you'll get a doublet peak. Your peak will, as you're scanning across, be twice as broad and not as high. And if you've got sufficient resolution, you'll actually see it go right down to zero and up again, it'll be double, it'll be split. Now, according to things that I've calculated, they may be out of phase. They refer to two phase conditions for coupling. Now, if you have two atoms, you'll have there, you'll have a triplet. That is one, the central peak will be two, and the side one peak. And I think, I don't know whether it goes Pascal's triangle, but it will actually go out there. So yeah, I think you can have up to eight atoms, and it will broaden out to a nine peak affair. So when you're looking at this, not only will you get information about the actual local magnetic field environment that the protons are in, but those protons will blab. They'll start to complain about the number of protons beside each other. Now, what this means is that you can get a signal inside, and you can start to get out masses of chemical information. You can see the environment, the magnetic environment that something is involved in, and that your actual proton is involved. So I hope this is not making too much noise. So I hope this is recording reasonably well. But you can also get in your peak, you can say, and this is from a proton in this type of bond, and I can also tell you the number of hydrogens on its next nearest neighbours. Now, this next nearest neighbour one will then be able to, it will produce peaks. Each one of them will produce a different peak, and this will blab about its next nearest neighbour. Now, you can imagine if you pass this to two things, you pass it to your local detective, there's basically three types of people. Your local detective, who will tell you dipshit. They'll tell you, well, we know, and basically tell the information back to you, because they're not used to processing it. You can tell it to a super smart geek, and they'll be able to imagine and work it out. So a student, or you can hand it over to a computer scientist who will write out a formula and basically create different molecules and form it up a rule. I suppose you could almost eventually hit it with artificial intelligence. So one of these things is, like, this is something which has huge amounts of information. So you can imagine this plus another technique would just completely explode it. And these MRIs or NMRs don't have to be big. You basically have to be enough to put a little drop of the particle in there. And I don't know, it would be just really super great, great to go on. Now, the interesting thing is that I don't know what in a hydrogen bond, the hydrogen bond is not a special type of electron bond. Okay, electrons are involved, but it is bonding using hydrogen. I know this is a big shock to a lot of people. Chemistry. Some people are told about the bonds formed by electrons. Well, okay, but a lot of us involve water and DNA, and hydrogen bonds mean a major thing. This is the fundamental things with lots of electrons. They like to share the hydrogens, and the hydrogen will move. So I don't know what the NMR spectra of something which is this loose free hydrogen bond. So I don't know whether if you have your organic molecule diluted in water, it's as if nothing's there because there's hydrogen bonds there. There's a whole series of, I suppose, fundamental questions that I have, but I unfortunately don't have friends. Well, stop by, I don't have friends that I can can chat it with, but I do know enough to know that people are dangerously ignorant. That is, they know sufficiently little to know that what they're saying is wrong. I don't know, it's socially you have these busybodies who are not sufficiently smart and connected and moral to know they shouldn't say anything, or that the fact that they're not contradicted is because people are aware of the ethical responsibility to be right. That's definitely in a social situation, and this has very much emerged with the teaching of chemistry, and in this case chemistry, nuclear chemistry, looking at these things. So let's do a little summary of it before I go on to my next and closing topic. If I have an organic sample, and if I put it in a very strong magnetic field and hit it with a tunable radio frequency field, I will get, coming out of that, a series of echo pulses. The strength of the echo pulse will determine the actual strength of the transmitter, but also the strength of absorption. So I can just scan the different frequencies, like change my tune, and I will get a series of beeps, notes back as I tune the frequency. And from this, I can see the location of these beeps to get the local magnetic environment, but also a coupling. And it will tell me about the nearest neighbour aspects of it. So more than it's all this fantastic thing in terms of that you take an X-ray of one bone and you get told from that X-ray, you can actually infer things way off that X-ray. Now, the amount of information is horrendous when you come to get into it, and it gives you a huge detail to it, and eventually I suppose you must need supercomputers to decombobulate this type of stuff. So that's what NMR are, and I suppose if I'm frustrated, I'm not causing anyone harm, I'm just privately frustrated. It's sort of like someone having private road rage to themselves, but smiling on the outside, but raging on the inside. Yeah, that's essentially it. But there's this great thing that I have this great joy of knowing about NMR spectroscopy. Okay, thanks a lot for listening. I'll get on to the next topic.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.